Good evening. One officer is indicted in Kentucky in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor, but not for killing the woman shot in her own home. A New York court orders Eric Trump to testify now, and memorial services for irreplaceable justice and secret tapes reveal plans to despoil Alaska for a gold mine. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. A Manhattan Supreme Court judge rejected a request from Eric Trump Wednesday to postpone his deposition until after the election in a probe of the Trump Organization's financial dealings. Justice Arthur Engoron said Eric Trump's justification for the delay was unpersuasive and noted that the attorney general and the court were not bound by timeliness of the national election. He ordered Eric Trump to sit for questioning by October 7th. The New York Attorney General is investigating whether President Trump's company broke the law by inflating the value of properties to obtain tax breaks and other financial benefits. James seeks to question Eric Trump because he heads a corporate entity that owns Trump properties at the center of the investigation. And a Kentucky grand jury brought no charges against Louisville police for the killing of Breonna Taylor during a drug raid gone wrong, with prosecutors saying Wednesday that two officers who fired their weapons at the black woman were justified in using force to protect themselves. Protesters in Louisville are protesting at this hour. Others express frustration with the police.
You just kick the door down and just bang, and get away with it. The police have become gang members with badges. That's what they are. They're worse than the Bloods and Crips could ever be.
The only charges brought by the grand jury were three counts of wanton endangerment against fired officer Brett Hankison for shooting at the Taylor's neighbors' homes during the raid on the night of March 13th. The FBI is still investigating potential violations of federal law in the case. Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron.
The grand jury voted to return an indictment against Detective Hankison for three counts of wanton endangerment for wantonly placing the three individuals in apartment three in danger of serious physical injury or death. The charge of wanton endangerment in the first degree is a Class D felony, and if found guilty, the accused can serve up to 5 years for each count. Kentucky law states that a person is guilty of wanton endangerment in the first degree when under circumstances manifesting in strict indifference to the value of human life, he wantonly engages in conduct which creates a substantial danger of death or serious physical injury to another person. My office is prepared to prove these charges at trial.
Cameron says Kentucky law makes the cops' actions legal.
The use of force by Mattingly and Cosgrove was justified to protect themselves. This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death.
Taylor, an emergency medical worker, was shot multiple times by officers who entered her home on a no-knock warrant during a narcotics investigation. Cameron, who's the state's first black attorney general, said the officers acted in self-defense after Taylor's boyfriend fired at them. He added that Hankinson and the other two officers who entered Taylor's apartment announced themselves before entering and so did not execute the warrant as no-knock, according to the investigation. Cameron said one witness says they heard the cops announce themselves before entering the apartment.
Statements that were made by officers there the night or the morning of March 13th show that they did knock and announce. The important point here is that information was corroborated by another witness who was in close proximity to apartment four, who corroborated that information and said that there was a knocking and announcing by the officers. The witness was a civilian.
Reporters asked if one witness in a building where many tenants knew each other was enough to say the cops' shootings were justified.
They got to hear and listen to all the testimony and made the determination that Detective Hankinson was the one that needed to be indicted.
Daniel Cameron, he says the next step is with the Department of Justice.
The FBI continues its investigation into violations, potential violations of federal law. I know that not everyone will be satisfied with the charges we've reported today. My team set out to investigate the circumstances surrounding Ms. Taylor's death. We did it with a singular goal in mind, pursuing the truth. Kentuckians deserve no less. The city of Louisville deserves no less.
Cameron, who is a Republican, is a protege of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and he's been tagged by some as McConnell's heir apparent. And with crowds of admirers swelling outside, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was remembered Wednesday at the court by grieving family, colleagues, and friends as a prophet for justice. Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt of Washington, D.C., compared Ginsburg to a prophet who imagined a world of greater equality and then worked to make it happen.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. God makes me lie down in green pastures. God leads me beside the still waters. God restores my soul. God guides me in the straight paths for God's name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. This was Justice Ginsburg's life's work, to insist that the Constitution deliver on its promise, that we the people would include all the people. She carried out that work in every chapter of her life. As an advocate arguing six times before this court for equal treatment for women and men, and as a path-marking role model to women and girls of all ages, who now know that no office is out of reach for their dreams, whether that is to serve in the highest court of our land, or closer to home for me, as the rabbi of their community. May you rest under the wings of the Shekhinah, knowing that you have tirelessly served us and this great country, the United States of America.
Washington already is consumed with talk of Ginsburg's replacement, but Chief Justice John Roberts focused on his longtime colleague.
Ruth used to ask, what is the difference between a bookkeeper in Brooklyn and a Supreme Court justice? Her answer, one generation. It has been said that Ruth wanted to be an opera virtuoso, but became a rock star instead. But she chose the law. Subjected to discrimination in law school and the job market because she was a woman, Ruth would grow to become the leading advocate fighting such discrimination in court. She was not an opera star, but she found her stage right behind me in our courtroom. There she won famous victories that helped move our nation closer to equal justice under law, to the extent that women are now a majority in law schools, not simply a handful. Later, she became a star on the bench, where she sat for 27 years. Her 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions will steer the court for decades. They are written with the unaffected grace of precision.
Chief Justice John Roberts. Legal scholars say Ginsburg will be missed by women, minorities, and others seeking justice. Professor Emerita of the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Marjorie Cohen.
She wrote a majority opinion in U.S. versus Virginia, where the Virginia Military Institute excluded women from admission. And her majority opinion said that that violated equal protection, which was very significant. Equal protection, the Equal Protection Clause denies the right to treat people differently, groups of people differently based upon their race, gender, etc. She said that sex differences cannot be used to denigrate members of either sex or place artificial constraints on an individual's opportunity. One of her most significant cases came in a dissent in the 2007 case of Ledbetter versus Tire and Rubber Company, where the majority upheld strict time limits for filing employment discrimination claims under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was very difficult for employees to know they had been discriminated against, particularly in salary and pay. And she pointed out that that's not always easy to determine. It's often hidden from the employees. In her dissent, Ginsburg challenged Congress to overturn the majority ruling in the Ledbetter case and change the law. And 2 years later, Congress agreed and passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act of 2009. Another one of Ginsburg's significant dissents came in the 2013 case of Shelby County versus Holder, where the majority struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which had established a formula for preclearance of jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination. And Ginsburg said throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. There is a case that has particular resonance for our current time, where it may be the court who decides who wins the election. Trump is already setting the stage for that. He said that we're counting on the federal courts to decide the election night winner, and he openly admitted he wants to fill the vacancy left by Ginsburg's death before Election Day so his justice can help fight mail-in ballots. But in Bush v. Gore, which was the 2000 opinion by the Supreme Court, where a 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court basically selected George W. Bush as the president, and she dissented. The majority of the court overruled the Florida Supreme Court's order for a statewide manual recount. It was a very close election. Usually conservatives are in favor of states' rights on guns, states' rights on abortion. In her dissent, Ginsburg noted the court's conclusion that a constitutionally adequate recount is impractical is a prophecy the court's own judgment will not allow to be tested. Such an untested prophecy should not decide the presidency of the United States. If Trump succeeds, what happens if he replaces her before the election, rushes it through the Senate? He's got the Senate in his pocket, he and Mitch McConnell, and confirm that justice. And then Trump is defeated. Presumably, Biden could also nominate someone, and it would be a big mess. But it is not going to be pretty, the battle on election night and leading up to inauguration. I should say also, Paul, that the court now has 8 members, 3 liberals and 5 conservatives. Chief Justice Roberts is not just a right winger, but he also really cares about the legitimacy of the Roberts Court. He ruled with the liberals to strike down an abortion restriction based on stare decisis, which means precedent, which the Supreme Court is supposed to follow, because they had decided the identical issue 4 years before. And he also voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act. So until Ginsburg died, Roberts had been the swing vote on the court, and a Trump appointment would substitute a right-wing justice for Ginsburg, making a 6-3 conservative majority. There would be clear votes to overrule Roe v. Wade and to strike down the Affordable Care Act.
Marjorie Cohen is professor emerita of the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former head of the National Lawyers Guild. Her website is marjoriecohen.com. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A direct line to the White House, but routed through a third party to hide it from public view. Easy access to Alaska's governor, as well as the state's 2 U.S. senators. A successful push to unseat 9 Republican state lawmakers who oppose their plan to build a massive gold and copper mine, the biggest in North America, near Bristol Bay, Alaska. Those were some of the boasts made by 2 top executives of a company trying to build the Pebble Mine in videotapes secretly recorded by an environmental group and made public Monday. It was a rare glimpse into the private discussions surrounding the company's heated campaign to win federal permits for the project, which environmentalists say will destroy a pristine part of Alaska and decimate its world-famous sockeye salmon fishery. This is some of what the CEO of Northern Dynasty Minerals, Ronald Thiessen, had to say.
Stop a mine that has 160,000 metric tons per day. The first deposit that we've discovered at Pebble, and there will be more, but the first one lasts 180 years. But when you've got 2,000 people working making $100,000 a year, and the state's collecting money, the area that we're in, the Lake and Penn Borough, which is the municipality, they have to understand there's hardly any people live in Western Alaska. In 50,000 square miles, there's 7,500 people. 80% of them. And Senator Murkowski, I mean, she's very political. She, in her heart, wants the project to go ahead. She will say things that appeal to sometimes people's emotions, but that won't do any damage to the project overall. So, Senator Murkowski, we feel good about. Senator Sullivan. So Murkowski isn't up for election. When a senator's not up for election, they don't do anything. And Sullivan's going into his second. So he's got a battle on his hands, and we're trying to work with him to make sure he doesn't go and say something negative.
Ronald Thiessen is the CEO of Northern Dynasty Minerals. He was recorded by environmentalists acting as potential investors in Alaska's Pebble Mine project. The Western Director and Senior Attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council is Joel Reynolds.
The company is a small, underfunded exploration group based in Canada. They don't have the funds to build the mine. They were at one point a small part of a partnership called the Pebble Partnership that had a number of major global mining companies among its participants. All of those major companies have left: Mitsubishi Corporation, Anglo American, Rio Tinto. First Quantum Minerals was the most recent one to get involved in 2018, but within 5 months walked away. It's a project that's been abandoned for all kinds of reasons, but the fundamental problem here is it's the wrong mine in the wrong place. You don't put a major open pit mine at the headwaters of a national treasure like the Bristol Bay wild salmon fishery.
I know there's a lot of permits that are necessary and permissions. Are they getting those or not?
They have begun to try. The most important federal permit is the subject of a permit application before the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers under the Clean Water Act. It's called a dredge and fill permit, and it's required in order for them to get permission to gouge this massive open pit mine into the landscape up there, destroying literally thousands of acres of pristine wetlands and hundreds of miles of streams. There are numerous state-level permits. Those applications are just beginning to be filed.
We've been listening to these tapes. What have we found out?
These tapes are a revelation. They're about an hour's worth of Zoom tapes that were made by the Environmental Investigation Agency. It's a nonprofit that specializes in undercover investigations. A conversation between the chief executive officers of the Canadian company, Northern Dynasty Minerals, and two potential investors who actually were investigators for the Environmental Investigation Agency. And the conversations cover a wide range of topics. The tapes present a very unfavorable picture of the company behind the mine and these two individuals who run that company.
How about the senators and governors and other political figures who were mentioned?
If I were the people, the elected officials who were the focus of those comments, I would be outraged. The executives were boasting about how any number of these elected officials were essentially under their control, supportive of the mine, when in fact, this is not the case. The reactions from the Alaska delegation borne that out. They have objected to it in the strongest terms and denied the claims of these executives. It's probably not landing well in that group of people.
Do you think it'll have any effect on the permit process?
Yes, I think it's going to have an effect on the permit process. I certainly hope it does. One of the big revelations that's most troubling to us is the fact that this company has applied for what they call a small mine. It's not small, really, but it would affect about 10% of the ore body that they contend is in the region and would last 20 years. But what these tapes explicitly testify to is that their actual plan is for a mine of 180 to 200 years or more, 10 times the size of the one for which they have applied to be permitted.
Why won't this project die?
Because the company itself, the small Canadian company called Northern Dynasty Minerals, has no other assets. It can't simply cancel this project without canceling its very existence. So you have a lot of people involved in the company, in the leadership of the company, among the shareholders for the company, who have over decades lost a lot of money, and they're hoping to recoup that. Indeed, they're hoping that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We have to protect this region, and that's what the people of Alaska overwhelmingly support.
Joel Reynolds is the Western Director and Senior Attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Bristol Bay Wild Salmon Fishery earns locals $1.5 billion each year. The project is opposed by 80% of local residents. At the Julian Assange extradition hearing in the Old Bailey, London, the court learned that Assange has Asperger's syndrome and would be at high risk if extradited to the United States, and was held under SAM, Special Administrative Measures, in an American prison. Rebecca Miles has been following the hearing and files this report.
The testimony Assange satisfies an assessment of Asperger's syndrome came on Wednesday from expert witness Quinton Dealey. Asperger's syndrome is a disorder characterized by significant difficulties in social interaction and nonverbal communication. And in addition to the diagnosis of Asperger's, he noted symptoms of depression and found it to be present with psychotic symptoms and anxiety. Defense barrister Edward Fitzgerald QC asked if there was a risk of suicide if Assange was extradited to the US. Dealey said his risk of suicide would be high under those circumstances. It's an outcome he fears, dreads, and has a horror of, said Dealey. During cross-examination, prosecutor James Lewis challenged the psychiatric diagnosis, arguing that Assange hosted a TV chat show on Russia Today and showed a court a discussion from the Frontline Club where Assange was deft and knowledgeable in answering questions from journalists. Dealey argued that both were highly structured environments and relied on his expertise. During the afternoon testimony, the court heard from the first witness to be called by the prosecution, Sina Faisal, a professor of forensic psychiatry at the University of Oxford, where he focuses on the relationship between mental illness and violent crime, the mental health of prisoners, and violence risk assessments. He's been asked by the US government to prepare a report on Assange and had visited him in Belmarsh. Faisal had seen Assange when he was in a moderate depressive state. During cross-examination by Edward Fitzgerald, he was asked if Assange was put under Special Administrative Measures, SAMs, where he could be isolated for 22 hours a day, limited contact with others and the outside world, and limited phone calls, which would be monitored. Could this make Assange's mental health worse? Faisal said, yes, there was a risk. Under UK-US extradition requests, there are some loopholes such as freedom of the press, mental health and well-being, and political motives. The defence is arguing heavy along those lines. UK hacker Gary McKinnon escaped extradition in 2012 thanks in part to his diagnosis of autism. The court adjourned. The hearing continues. Rebecca Miles, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
Rebecca Miles is covering the WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange's extradition hearing at the Old Bailey, London. The hearing is in its third week and is expected to end next Friday. And finally, Florida's Attorney General asked state and federal law enforcement on Wednesday to investigate possible election law violation after billionaire and former Democratic presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg helped raise more than $16 million for Florida felons to pay their debts so they can vote in the presidential election. Attorney General Ashley Moody sent letters to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the FBI, saying that further investigation is warranted. Governor Ron DeSantis had asked Moody to review allegations that Bloomberg and the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition had violated the law by offering incentives for voting. DeSantis and Moody are both Republicans. In 2018, voters approved a constitutional amendment to restore most felons' voting rights once they completed their sentences. The exception was for murderers and sex offenders. But when crafting the law to implement the amendment, the Republican-dominated legislature said that rights wouldn't be restored until all fines, court fees, and restitutions were paid. Bloomberg announced this week that he raised more than $16 million to help pay off the financial obligations for felons so they can vote. And that's the news for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry and Rebecca Miles. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.